Hillary Clinton is among the most famous women on earth, who, but for the US electoral college system, would have been America's first woman president, winning 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. Her 9 years as first lady to husband Bill between 1993 and 2001 seems almost a lifetime away now. But unbowed by the scandals that beset her, she went on to launch a political career as a senator, secretary of state, and then presidential candidate. Friend and foe agree on one thing. She's an extraordinary human being, lionized by her supporters, but demonized by opponents. In many respects, she's the best face of progressive America and one of its most influential exponents. She's got lots to say on the way society works, or should work, and the role of politicians in defining all that. The conversation you're about to hear was specially recorded for the We Society, and it was the only podcast interview she gave on a recent trip to the UK. Take it from me, she's on blistering form.
You know, it is so much easier to stoke people's fears and anger than it is to provide hope and constructive alternative. We have a lot of issues in our education system, but it's really hard to compete with screens. You basically save people from falling into unemployment. You save small businesses. What do you got to do to entertain me? We've got to do a better job because there's a big hill to climb. It's bread and circuses.
Today, I talk to one of the best regarded political figures in the world, Hillary Dine Rodham Clinton. Now, through her work with the Clinton Foundation, she's convening leaders from business, government and philanthropy to tackle the refugee crisis in Ukraine and around the world. Global health, climate change and economic growth that works for all. She's passionate about how education enfranchises and the necessity for women's equality. Remember those 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling at the end of the 2008 election campaign? Or her Twitter profile? She describes herself as a fan of walks in the wood and standing up for our democracy. Madam Secretary, thank you for joining us on the We Society. We're talking a lot as social scientists on the podcast series about how to reassert the we-ness of society after the excesses of individualism over the last few decades to marry individual and social responsibility. Hillary Clinton, what does the We Society mean to you?
Well, it means that whether we care to acknowledge it or not, we are truly all in this together. And in a democracy, the we is those of us who are citizens and the leaders that we choose to govern us. And if you recall, the preamble to our United States Constitution begins, we the people. So you're talking about the we society is rooted in very fundamental values about how we come together in solidarity to take collective action for the common good. And it is now in peril because of all of the developments socially, technologically, politically, economically, that have elevated individualism far above social needs or social desires. And so I think your podcast is particularly timely.
How do you unpack that? I mean, what's actually driving this? I mean, there's four or five things you identified there. But, I mean, the polarization in American society, and by the way, British society, is kind of mounting. Mm-hmm. Is it excess individualism? Is it technology? How can one kind of close these fissures? I mean, people talk about potential civil war in America, probably overstated, but that they can even talk about and not get laughed out of the room is a proxy for how serious things are. Your thoughts?
It's the combination of all of this. I mean, human nature has not changed dramatically in the last 50, 100, 200 years, but there have been a number of developments which sadly have elevated those leaders who play on people's fears rather than addressing them, who emphasize divisiveness over unity. And in particular, in our country, the combination of right-wing media led by Fox News, but also amplified by social media and deliberate efforts at disinformation and propaganda have kept people off balance. And then along comes the pandemic, which has been further destabilizing to many individuals, families, communities. So it's a witch's brew, isn't it?
I just want to pick your point up on the pandemic. I mean, in a sense, you know, I mean, the success of the vaccination program and actually the way in which those societies which actually emphasized weeness and actually acted collectively and promptly actually did better. I thought it might be the opportunity to kind of bring societies like the United States or the UK society together. It has probably not done that. Why do you think that's happened?
Well, I think it's because when the pandemic began, we had a leader in the White House who chose to deny and diminish the impact of the pandemic, who played again to people's fears, who tried to defy science, who recommended crackpot kinds of, you know, solutions like injecting yourself with bleach. You can't make this up. And he used to have a press conference every night, which I haven't looked at the exact figures, but I bet a really high percentage of Americans tuned into. And some of us couldn't believe our eyes, but others believed him. And the war on science, which goes hand in hand with efforts to create a post-fact world, I think is part and parcel of the kind of populism and demagoguery that we saw in the United States. And tragically, you know, based on reports I've read, we lost now more than a million people to the pandemic. And most of them, after vaccines came into use, this remarkable scientific achievement of creating vaccines in literally, faster time than anyone could have predicted, which the Trump administration could have and should have taken credit for, because it did start in terms of their push and their emphasis and investment in tax dollars into some of the pharmaceutical companies working on vaccines. But instead, you had a president who would not take a shot in public, although we know indeed he got it. And you had right-wing media led by Rupert Murdoch, who, as I understand it, was one of the very first people in the UK who got his vaccine and then permitted his broadcast network after vaccination was required of all of his employees, but permitted those on air to continue to sow doubt about vaccines. So, you know, what we're living in is a kind of alternative reality.
I'm trying to get behind kind of why they are so passionate, why they think they're so passionately right.
Who, the right-wing leaders or their followers? Oh, most of them don't believe they're passionately right. It's opportunism. You know, it is so much easier to stoke people's fears and anger than it is to provide hope and constructive alternatives. It is so much easier. And you have to be especially skilled in performance arts in today's politics to be able to promote hopefulness. You know, my husband was very skilled, Barack Obama was very skilled, but the performance side of politics has now superseded in many instances any kind of productivity. Yeah. And it is so much easier to attract and keep an audience. And then if you watch what happens on social media, you have people literally being led by algorithms into deeper and deeper conspiracies and, you know, social media rabbit holes that are aimed to ensnare them. And we see it in political campaigns, but we also see it now on a regular basis by people who are profiting. Look at the anti-vaxxers in the United States. You know, they are now trying to convince parents not to have their children vaccinated for all the childhood diseases. And there was a recent study, I think, in the New York Times, which looked at the 12 biggest personalities on social media, primarily Facebook, but not exclusively, who are peddling anti-vaccination propaganda. They are all making money from it in one way or the other. They are selling products like vitamins and lotions and potions instead of vaccines. And so this human nature to, you know, promote oneself, to try to turn a profit, has just been put on steroids because of our media ecosystem right now.
Is some of the kind of problem that actually the best of the kind of Enlightenment tradition in the States, the best of the, those who want to argue the case for weeners, are not able to kind of put it together as well as they can?
Well, it's. I think it's much.
Well, are we partly responsible for all of this?
Well, I'm sure we are, but it's really hard, Will. I mean, it is so much harder to drive a message on social media that is hopeful and positive than one that is fearful and negative. It just is. And so I think about my husband, and, you know, he was the man from hope, and that was both literally true, and it was also his political messaging. Fox News did not start until 1996, so he was already on his way to being reelected. Barack Obama, who was hope and change, and again, the same kind of mentality that has in the past been very good at capturing people's attention and their voting, you know, his first campaign in 2008 was, you know, not particularly impacted by social media. He was very good at organizing people on social media platforms, but the real impact of social media combined with a long-term, relentless process led by the right wing in our country didn't really take hold until Trump became their avatar. You know, the performance aspect of politics has always been there. You know, people who can give a great speech, who can attract votes and eyeballs and all the rest of it.
Charisma.
But the negative function that is now at the heart of performance politics, the fear, you saw it in Brexit. I mean, people made up all kinds of wacky stuff. They lied shamelessly. And the other side was kind of, you know, bollocks. They didn't know what to do or say and didn't do a very good job of it, because when you're on the opposite side of shameless lying, you really are thrown off balance. I mean, how do you respond to that? And so we do have to do a better job, those of us who believe in trying to bring people together and all the other aspects of the we society, as you call it. We've got to do a better job. But it's really hard because there's a big hill to climb.
If they made you kind of go for a day, are there two or three things you would try and do that would kind of address this? What would you do?
Oh, look, I think that if we don't begin to regulate social media, and I really applaud the European Union for its recent actions to try to rein in the big tech companies, but if we don't try to come up with some effective way of holding them accountable for what they publish on their platforms, it is almost impossible to imagine that we can get back into a fact-based world. And I say that with great regret, but I think there is enough evidence now to show that the algorithms are designed to capture your attention, and what best captures your attention? The car wreck. The sensationalist story. Those of us on the side that really believe we should have moderate, determinant decisions made on social media, you should not be able to say that the vaccines for COVID will make you infertile, will cause you to drop dead. You should not be able to say that. There is no basis in fact for it. And so when social media platforms try to rein it in, you know, there is a huge outcry about free speech. It has nothing to do with free speech. You know, free speech, in our understanding of it in the United States, is protecting speech from government intervention, not from business decisions. And usually the business decision is let it rip, say whatever you want to say. So Elon Musk wants to own a platform so he can say whatever he wants to say. So he now has switched from somebody who voted for me, voted for Joe Biden, to saying, these Democrats, these you know, we society people, they're trying to rein in free speech. They're trying to tell me what to do. And they want to regulate that. So no, I am going to own one of the biggest you know, global platforms, and I will, you know, prevent that. You know, if you really strip it all away, this is about power, and it is about money, and it is about ideology, often mixed with religious fundamentalist views.
Yeah, that's another dimension of it, yeah. Religious fundamentalism. Mm-hmm. And also the gross inequalities that emerged in the United States with phenomenal kind of billionaires who are able to kind of, like Elon Musk, richest man in the world, play, you know, to fork out $43 billion.
Look, I don't have any problem with people making a lot of money. I don't. Especially people who invent something, who create something. But I have a big problem if it paralyzes the government, the instrument of the we, in trying to rein in predatory capitalism, to try to rein in monopolistic behavior or consumer harm. I have a real problem with that. So I think it's a false canard when people say, well, the problem is you have billionaires. Well, we had billionaires when Franklin Roosevelt was president, and he reined them in. We had billionaires when Harry Truman was president, and he went toe-to-toe with the steel industry. And, you know, Dwight Eisenhower warned against the military-industrial complex, and I could go on and on. The government has to represent the public good. And that means reining in the excesses of those who are seeking and acquiring massive wealth. And it should also include, and this is part of the other reason that Elon Musk and some of his fellow billionaires are so upset, it should also include a tax system that gets them to pay their fair share.
Before we carry on the conversation, just a quick word about the organization behind the podcast series. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body established in 1982. It's for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. As the leading independent voice in the UK, it champions the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, and in business. What is that role? Well, social sciences help us to understand the human world. That means solving grand challenges like climate change, wealth creation, or energy crises. It might mean working out the practicalities of levelling up the regions of Britain, monitoring happiness, maintaining standards of education, or addressing racial equality. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Or you can follow us on Twitter at @AcadSocSciences. You'll find those details in our show notes. Back to the conversation.
Education,
yeah,
is a big part of your thinking, and yet, you know, what a kind of nut to crack, you know, that actually the big, what you want to enfranchise people who at the bottom of the bottom 3, 4, 5 deciles of society. How to get the resource, how to get the people, how to get the passion, how to get the structures. Over to you.
Well, I mean, education is, you know, at the core of any democratic society, but it has to be recognized that for large segments of people, and again, speaking primarily about the United States, it hasn't worked as effectively as it needs to. And there are a number of reasons for that. There are communities that are woefully under-resourced when it comes to providing public education for their children, and they need more government assistance than they are currently getting. There's a lot of evidence that the first 5 years of life are critical in developing vocabulary and thinking skills, and there needs to be more emphasis on preschool education of high quality. There's also a problem in the United States where too many people are not encouraged to pursue trades and crafts and careers that would make a very good living for them. And so they kind of get, you know, shuffled away from the four-year colleges, and they should be encouraged into community colleges and apprenticeship programs. But it's really hard to compete with screens. I've had veteran teachers who have taught for 10, 20, 35 years. When I ask them, what's the difference now between the kids you have and the kids you used to have? You know, they've taught maybe in the same school, same socioeconomic, racial mix of kids. And they said, now, you know, kids' eyes just glaze over. They're so used to entertaining themselves on a screen. I'm not that entertaining. I'm trying to get them to understand multiplication or, conjugating verbs. And I am being turned off. She said, one of them said to me, I can just see their eyes like turning me off. I'm not entertaining enough. And so all of the issues about education that we know, the structural and systemic issues, are now made even harder because of the challenge of teachers in classrooms competing with this omnipresent screen that children have access to.
This question of the screen is also evidence, isn't there, that actually excessive focus on the screen actually starts to kind of change the synapses.
Yes.
And you really, downgrade emotional intelligence, mm-hmm. capacity to kind of interact with mm-hmm. others. Actually, arguably, you could argue one of the enemies of a wee society is excess screen time.
I agree with that completely, because part of the foundation of a we society are people with self-discipline and impulse control and delayed gratification capacity. And what we're seeing evidence of are kids who are made more anxious, sometimes depressed, by their intensive use of social media and the screen time. And one of the great ironies of this is that a number of the executives in Silicon Valley who create and promote the screens and what goes on them forbid their own children, and in fact write into contracts with babysitters and nannies and others who have any kind of contact with their children, they can't show them screens. And so you just have to shake your head in wonderment that people who know how powerful these screens are in affecting brain development don't want that for their own children, but are more than happy to have millions of other children, have access to screens because it makes them a lot of money.
Again, part of your story about getting to grips with digital power. Another way of thinking about the we society and how it kind of locates in your thinking, you may think it's a bit fanciful on my part, but I'm going to try it out on you. I mean, you're a passionate feminist, women's equality, but actually, one of the ways that one can kind of think of that is that no we society is possible unless men and women are equal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it's men's interest that they buy into this.
Mm-hmm.
I was struck by this recently when there was a famous case here in Britain where a woman CEO, speaking at an AGM with her investors, was going quite well. And then who's wearing the trousers around here? We need a man around here. There was a revulsion, of course, and lots and lots of kind of people taking her side in the press afterwards. But most of them, I noted, were women.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, time has come, really, to kind of reframe this.
We've made a lot of advances. And, in 1995, I gave a speech in Beijing about, women's rights or human rights. And we also adopted a platform for action that was aimed at the full participation of women in every aspect of society. We saw a lot of global progress. However, I think we're now living through something of a backlash because the pressures on women, again, I would say both in real life and in social media, are just increasing exponentially. The amount of misogynism on social media is stunning. You also have a kind of growing pushback on women being given a real chance to compete equally in lots of different settings. So I think it's a never-ending responsibility, and you're 100% right that you can't really talk about some kind of we society unless the we includes everybody.
Yeah.
Now, when our Constitution was written...
But
when our Constitution was written, they wrote we the people, women were not included, slaves were not included, men without property were not included, but we have advanced beyond that, and the progress that we've made so that women find themselves in so many more positions in the economy and society is... it's not enough. And it's also, as I say, there is an organized pushback against a lot of the progress that women have made. And the pandemic was especially harmful to women and girls.
We only have minutes left, and we can't let you go without getting you to kind of just give some insight of what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in Russia, how you see this class of civilization panning out. I mean, what's your take? What's the end game?
Well, I think the end game is that we have to do everything we can to help the Ukrainians defend themselves and to create a strategic defeat for Putin and Russia. I think that this is a huge challenge, not just to Ukraine and not even just to Europe, but to the entire world of democracies and free people, because Putin has a view of himself and his place in history. Yeah, yeah. I've met with him. He played a major role in my defeat in 2016. And despite Trump's efforts to deny it, it is provable over and over again. He very much wanted Trump to win because he saw Trump as a, you know, somewhat malleable character, or as I called him in one of the debates, Putin's puppet. And I believe that if Trump had been reelected, the United States would have been pulled out of NATO. We were pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords by Trump. We were pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. And boy, what a mistake that was. Iran is, if not already there, certainly very close. They're going to have, they probably already do have, enough highly enriched uranium for, you know, the making of nuclear weapons. And I think Trump would have, and still would, if given the chance, pull us out of NATO, because that was at the top of Putin's wish list. And what we see Putin doing now is not only this horrific attack on Ukraine and the destruction of Ukrainian cities and the murder of innocent Ukrainians. He really wants to assert Russian power back into Europe. And it's one of the reasons why the leaders of the Baltics, for example, are so adamant that we have to help the Ukrainians.
Well, what about this evolution in American thinking, among Democrats in particular, that actually you have to develop multilateralism around trusted partners,
mm-hmm.
and one really has to, you know which way is up when you're dealing with Russia and China.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, what's that going to mean for the way globalization is configured over there?
Well, I think you're seeing it in action right now. I give the Biden administration tremendous credit for rebuilding, you know, trust among our allies in the year after Trump left and before Russia invaded Ukraine. That was hard work. And Biden had sufficient experience, as did his, you know, top diplomats and White House personnel, to be able to go to Europe and go to Japan and go to South Korea and go to Australia and go to the places where we have had long-term relationships and where even in some cases we have treaties, like the, you know, NATO treaty, and basically rebuild the trust that had been shattered by Trump. I don't think we would be seeing what we're seeing in Ukraine right now, which is most, if not all, of Europe either providing weapons or signing on to sanctions or taking refugees, plus Canada and the United States, plus our allies in the Asian Pacific area like Japan, who have signed on to what is an alliance effort to protect the gains of the post-World War II era. And so I am very, you know, very complimentary of what President Biden and his team have been able to do, as evidenced by how we are responding to Ukraine.
And yet the Russian army is grinding in the same way it did in Syria, you know, heavy shelling,
mm-hmm.
humanitarian corridors,
mm-hmm.
destroying towns.
It's just tragic, and it's barbaric. And I was very pleased that recently the president has given the okay to provide longer-range missile systems to the Ukrainians. So I think that the president, President Biden, is doing all that he can to equip the Ukrainians to protect themselves and defend themselves. And it's really imperative that nobody get out ahead of the Ukrainians. I disagree completely with some of the pundits and pontificators who have said, oh, well, we need to try to force the Ukrainians to the negotiating table with Russia. Absolutely not. These people have paid in their blood for their freedom and their, you know, young democracy, and it's not our place or anybody else's place to tell them what their goals should be. We should provide them with as much military support as we can. We should impose as tough a set of sanctions on Russia as we can, and be there for the longer run. I mean, part of our problem with a we society is our short attention span, and we have to stay committed to help the Zelensky government and the Ukrainian people.
When President Biden got elected, he said, "I hope my presidency goes well. I fear for our country if it doesn't." End on a hopeful note, will you? Or give an honest assessment, whatever is your view.
Well, look, I think that if you actually study the facts, President Biden has got a lot done. And he's got a lot done with respect to legislation that he's gotten passed, most notably the American Rescue Plan and the bipartisan infrastructure plan. That's going to put a lot of Americans to work. It's going to repair and build a lot of the infrastructure that we've allowed to deteriorate. It's a major accomplishment. And then he's also gotten many other things accomplished as well. But he's not a performer, as we think of a performer in today's terms. Your prime minister in this country is a performer. Donald Trump is a performer. Great. But what do they actually do? And what do they do that actually translates into positive results for people? That should be the standard, not whether I find him entertaining on my television screen or I can't believe what's coming out of his mouth next. And that is hard for somebody like Joe Biden, who is a workmanlike, effective political leader. But the times that we are living in, particularly the media world in which we find ourselves, is bored by accomplishment, bored by productivity. Okay, so you basically save people from falling into unemployment. Ah, you save small businesses. Ah, you're going to build, you know, airports and bridges and tunnels and all kinds of great things. Ah, what do you got to do to entertain me? And this is something that I don't know the way forward, because it is a real problem for democracy, because it's bread and circuses. Keep them entertained. Keep them deflected. Don't let them look at me. Don't let them hold me accountable. Just keep throwing more stuff at them that will hopefully divert them from the fact we're not doing something, or we're telling them to, you know, ingest bleach, but just keep going. And so Biden has done a very, you know, credible job as president. And yet, you know, people, they can't explain exactly why they are not lit up and excited about him, but it's because he's not a performer. And that is a real problem.
Madam Secretary, that is a fantastic tour of the horizon you've given us. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
We've touched on performative politics and its rise. You pointed the finger at the rise of the tech giants and the abuse of data and the abuse of information. You've said that actually American history gives you optimism that centers of power like this can be taken on. You don't have to be frightened of billionaires.
Mm-hmm.
You've reasserted your commitment to education and women's equality and given us some hope.
Absolutely.
About what's happening, you know, in Ukraine.
Well,
Will,
I'll end with a quote from my wonderful late friend, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who, when she used to be asked, how do you define yourself? She would say, oh, I am an optimist who worries a lot.
I'm also going to call you a social scientist. To the We Society.
I am. Thank you. Onward together, as we say. Thank you.
The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. If you want to find out more about future episodes, please subscribe in the usual way. Why not leave us a review? I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production.